You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 19th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Happy birthday, Cara Santa Maria.
Oh, howdy, thanks.
Jane Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Cara, today's your actual birthday, and you're recording the SGU.
I know. I'm so dedicated.
Dedicated. Yes, you are. Crazy.
I'm skepticated.
I'm so skepticated that I went to a really awesome skeptic conference in Manchester this past weekend.
Manchester, QED. United Kingdom.
QED. Question, Explore, Discover. It was so much fun, you guys. And I missed you.
No, I know.
A lot of people gave hugs.
That would have been
dying
so cool.
To go. Too. Yeah, you gave. I sent Andy a virtual hug through you, mm-hmm. Andy Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lots of fans of the SGU there. It was really cool to meet so many fun people. Lots of really great speakers. Richard Wiseman was there, of course. Susan Blackmore was there. A lot of other really great speakers. It was a ton of fun. Oh, and I got to interview Sue Blackmore for my other podcast that I do, Talk Nerdy, which was a lot of fun. And there was great magic tricks and all of the wonderful things that you expect from a skeptic conference, except everybody had an accent and we ate baked beans for breakfast.
Did you have any bangers and mash?
I didn't have any bangers and mash, but I ate baked beans every morning. Which is weird, but kind of amazing.
When I was there, I had to have the bangers and mash just because, you know, why not? It's what you have to do when you're visiting England. Uh-huh. And I hated it. I thought it was terrible.
I did have like a meat pie and it was super gross. But I had dinner one night with Iran, which was so fun from Australian skeptics. And we had a really good steak. So that was cool.
So what was your highlight?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I'm so bad at the highlight question. I think it was just meeting so many great people. It was definitely on the upper end of warm and friendly skeptic conferences. Like, everybody was super sweet, super respectful. And it's so much fun when you get to go across the pond or just go somewhere that's far from home, because it makes you realize how small the world really is. How there's these people that listen to you that live thousands and thousands of miles away. And we're all really just one big community.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, Bob, you're going to start us off with a forgotten superhero of science.
Okay, for this week's Superheroes of Science, I'm going to talk about Stanislav Petrov, who is a retired lieutenant colonel of the Soviet Air Force Defense Forces. He's a superhero in my mind because he was a critical thinker, and because of that, he probably saved more than half a billion people, if not many more. This is a real fun story that I was not aware of. Petrov's job in 83 was to look at satellite surveillance data, which was designed to spot a United States missile attack, probably among other things, and report it up the chain of command. Now this was early 80s. This was a time when tensions were high. There was the Soviet downing of the Korean Airlines flight 007. There was tough nuclear talk being tossed around. And on that day, on that fateful day, the system told them that 5 missiles were launched by the U.S. and were, I think, only minutes away. They were very close. Bruce Blair, who's a nuclear strategies expert, he said the top leadership, given only a couple of minutes to decide, told that an attack had been launched, would make a decision to retaliate. So he thinks that if Petrov did report this as he was supposed to, that things would have gone very poorly. Petrov, though, as I said, was clearly a critical thinker. He knew that an American attack would likely be far more than just 5 missiles. To him, it wasn't logical that there would just be 5 missiles. He also knew at the time that the system was fairly new. This was not a tried and true system. This was new, which also set off his skeptical alarms. And to top it off, the ground radar hadn't really seen anything, even after a few minutes. Had he just reacted, as many people would have at that time, it's kind of hard to imagine how many lives would have been lost. It could have been obviously devastating. They would have fired on us, and then we would have just retaliated, and bam, it would have been a full blown Holocaust. It would have been nasty.
So nuclear remember, nuclear combat toe to toe with the Ruskies.
So remember, Stanislav Petrov, mention him to your friends. Perhaps when watching Mad Max or playing Fallout 4.
Hey.
Or watching Dr. Strangelove. Hey,
not complicated.
Hey, just for SGU listeners, Fallout 4 is on sale in the Steam store until the 25th.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Jay, speaking of rockets, which is only tangentially related to the previous item. There's been a lot of talk about Mars in the last few weeks.
There has. I don't even know where to begin. So we have a couple of cool things going on. I'll start with President Obama. Okay, so last week, President Obama said that he set a goal for the United States to land a manned mission on Mars by the year 2030.
By the 2030s.
2030s, fine. Oh. If you want to be accurate. He did this in an editorial he wrote on the CNN website. He said that private companies are going to have to get involved. You know, NASA is trying to help these private companies develop habitats or habitat technology by giving away $65 million in support over the next couple of years, which is awesome. And, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but NASA has actually been talking about a Mars-based mission in the 2030s for a number of years, for quite a long time, actually. So Obama is really just confirming that that date range is still alive and the intent is still there. So getting back to the habitat thing, the habitat, now I'm not actually talking about the habitats that they would need when they're on the planet. I'm talking about the habitats of getting them to the planet. Because, the way that we've done things traditionally with most space travel, all space travel, it's been in incredibly cramped quarters. And if you're telling an astronaut or anybody that's traveling into outer space, you know, it's going to take 3 days to get to the moon. And then, you know, you have another 3 day ride back, but you're going to have kind of a break at the moon because you're going to be working and doing all this stuff. That's one thing. But if you say to them, hey, you're going to probably be in this capsule for 6 months. And you're going to have enough room to get out of your chair and move across and then, you know, stand up and then you got to get back in your chair. People are going to go nuts. So they don't want to just give them VR headsets like I've been telling NASA in spammy types of emails I send them 400 or 500 times a day because I think my idea is fantastic. But they actually want a bigger living space. So that's why NASA is actually trying to help companies, you know, to give them money to start up projects to help develop concepts that are going to lead to better habitats, which I think is fantastic. And, you know, we have other good things, you know, still in the works. So NASA has their, the Space Launch System, the SLS, and they have their Orion crew capsule, which both of these are being built as we speak. We really don't know, of course, what if Clinton or Trump wins, we don't know what they're going to do. We have really no way of determining that. And anything that they say during their campaigns, you know, we have to take with a grain of salt, like everything else that they say. But Clinton did say that it's critical to ensure that NASA has the resources and the predictable funding to do what it needs to do to achieve its goals. Thank you. That was a nice nod. And ironically, Trump just said today, October 19th, 2016, that he plans to reinstitute a National Space Policy Council headed by his vice president. And I do think that this is in response to President Obama's Mars goal comment. And we can only hope that whoever wins, they take all of this seriously. You know, space exploration isn't just fun. It's great to watch as a fan of it and everything, but it's also fantastic for humanity. It's just an overall great thing for humanity to do. I think it brings us together. You know, binds us in the dark together, like the rings from Tolkien.
Yes. Yeah.
But let's click over to another news item. Let's talk about Mr. Musk. Evan, I know you're a big fan of Elon's.
Elon Musk.
He did. He brought you up today in a talk that he gave.
Well, I'm kidding. It's only fair I brought him up in a talk once, so now we're even.
So Elon Musk recently announced that SpaceX's future plans at the 67th Annual International Aeronautical Congress in Guadalajara, Mexico. There are a bunch of people that are involved in space travel in one way or the other. And they're, you know, they're like agency heads and senior executives and of the world's big space agencies. And they get together every year and they give a symposium and they talk about all these different aspects of what's going on in their industry and just lots of really in-depth discussions. And Elon went to this conference and announced this whole thing, his final plan for Mars, or at least, you know, his overarching plan, not the extraordinary details, of course, but just gives a really good overview of what's going on. So the plans include a ton of new technology, of course, giant, reusable, and incredibly powerful rocket engines, state-of-the-art carbon fiber fuel tanks. His crew vessel, check this out, guys, will be able to carry over probably 100 and over passengers to Mars in one capsule,
what?
Drop them off, and come back to Earth for more passengers. And if you don't know already, Musk wants to build a sustainable civilization there. So let me give you like the quick overview of the whole thing. He gave some interesting estimates on the costs. He said, today his guess is that it would be about $10 billion per seat. That's today, in today's dollars.
How many?
$10 billion per seat with 100 people?
No, let me give you the whole thing. You'll get it after I get through
okay,
this, right? So
okay.
He's saying today it would cost $10 billion to put someone on this on the ship. And that's, of course, a ton of money, but there's also, and there's only about 1,800 billionaires in the world. And I don't think most of them have $10 billion. I think that most of them break the billion barrier. But still, that's not a lot of people, right? So, of course, that can't be what his end goal is. But, of course, Musk says once they improve the technology, they develop more materials that they'll be doing this over the next decade, he thinks that that number will come down to a very manageable $200,000 per seat. Now,
totally manageable.
Yeah, that's a great number if it's achievable. You know, he's going from this $10 billion to $200,000, you know, huge spectrum there. But he's saying that it has a huge, heavy, essential requirement on reusable technology. And as you guys know, most of the space technology is not reusable in the sense that he's talking about. Like with the space shuttle, we had the rocket boosters. They were reusable. Thank you. The space shuttle itself was reusable. Fantastic. That was a step in the right direction. But Elon is like, when he says reusable, he's like, it lands, they refuel it, they give it a quick diagnostic, and they send that thing back up, you know? And you know, engines that can take variations in fuel and all sorts of different things to make the systems flexible and all this stuff. So if you haven't seen the video, it's awesome. SpaceX made this awesome animation video to show you, like, you know, just the overview of the people getting on the ship and the launches and everything. So here's my quickie textual version of the overview. 100 people board a 40-story rocket powered by 42 Raptor engines. These are the much, much more powerful engines that they came up with. It takes the crew into orbit, and the first stage returns to Earth, and it now brings all the fuel back up to the original craft back into orbit, and it does a couple of refueling missions. It tops off the capsule that's holding all of the crew, and then once that happens, they go up to Mars. They immediately start their trip to Mars. The cruise ship is accelerated to about 19,000 miles per hour or 30,500 kilometers per hour, and at that speed, it's a three-month ride to Mars. And he said that he wants, you know, this is Elon, and he likes to say a lot of awesome stuff, but he weaves in some weird stuff as well. He said he wants the crew to have a lot of fun. He says the trip will be extraordinarily entertaining, and they're going to have pizza on the ship. Now, you got to respect this guy when he's flat out saying they're going to be on the ship and there's going to be frickin' pizza aboard. That's cool. I think it's, you know, it's just the right attitude. It's as silly.
How?
As
you can't have pizza in space.
Yes, you can.
Space can have space
you
pizza.
Can. Yeah, you can have space pizza, but that's like not as good.
It probably won't be, Kara,
it's
but
like
it,
Chicago deep dish space pizza.
Yeah, I would imagine that the bread wouldn't rise the right way. Whatever. It's pizza. Close enough. You know, it'll be better than probably what you got served in school when you were a kid, those frozen pizzas that they gave us that were nasty, but you paid a buck a pop and you probably ate three or four of them. Anyway, so once in orbit around Mars, the ship will use its friction to slow itself down using the planet's atmosphere. And it's actually a really cool premise because the atmosphere is not that thick on Mars. And they could use the atmosphere as a real, real speed you know, how would you say it? Like, it's just going to deaccelerate the ship very slowly with the atmosphere. It's really cool. If you see the video, you'll get a better idea. Once the ship slows down enough, SpaceX's retro rockets will fire and slow the ship down to a vertical landing. And at this point in the trip, everyone on the ship should be reminded why they're doing this. So I think that Elon needs to have, like, his voice come over loudspeakers and their headsets or whatever. And according to Elon, the trip is to, it's for humans to become a spacefaring and multiplanetary species and to preserve the species. Mars is close. It has frozen water on it, and it has other essentials to human life in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide, nitrogen. You know, it has a lot of the stuff that we need there already. The Martian regolith has the potential to refuel the craft using harvested methane, which I did not know about. Very cool. And being that Mars has, what, about a third of Earth's gravity, the engines don't have to work anywhere near as hard or have anywhere near as much fuel to get the ship back into orbit. And this is also a huge cost saver, again, because the ship is not dead on Mars once it lands. They are going to take that ship and put it back up into orbit and then push it back to Earth and then repopulate it and have the cycle start all over again. So his long-term vision, blue skies on Mars, Quade the reactor, 2 weeks. Anybody?
Yeah.
Nope. Yes, yes. Okay.
I can tell people's age range by their response. Kara said nope, and she is, nope. is Jesus' age today. And Evan and Bob and Steve know it. Of course, they know it. I was with them when they saw the freaking movie. That was from
Total Recall.
Total Recall?
Total.
Anybody? Thank you. Some of you said yes. Okay, so Elon wants a city on Mars populated with millions of people. And this will, of course, be a Herculean effort, bigger than anything humanity has ever done before. It'll take thousands of ships, tens of thousands of missions, and a half or an entire lifetime worth of years to pull off, you know, 40 to 100 years.
And you're really just talking about the ships. You're not talking about the settlement. We'll just leave that up to the future.
You didn't get into it. It's not...
That's just like, eh, yeah. It's a hurdle.
Bussing people to Mars is probably the easiest component of establishing a Mars colony.
Right? Yeah. We're just not going to worry about the settlement at all.
Not that I read. I mean, I'm sure that he has plans, and they're working. You know, you're not going to build.
Yeah, we'll just 3D print it.
I wouldn't be surprised if they're
going to
be
part of the.
It's going to be a huge part of the plan.
So Musk is not just though selling his dream. This is the other cool thing that came out of the conference. He's also looking for investors. He doesn't have all the SpaceX doesn't have the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars it's going to take to do this. So he wants to find other rich investors that are sharing his vision. And great. There's a lot. There's 1,800 of them out there. Elon, go track them down. He has all his technology moving in the right direction, which is good. He's, he is having quite a lot of success with everything that we're seeing SpaceX do. He's, not afraid for failure, which is another great attitude. I've been following SpaceX really closely. I'm a huge fan, and I share his dream. I think it's awesome. I would have liked a moon base first, a long time ago, larger, longer term, livable orbiting space stations with rotating habitats, simulated gravity, all that would have been awesome. I don't know why we're jumping past that and going right to Mars. But Mars is an incredible idea. I completely back it. I'm super excited. I just hope that we don't have a mass death on these missions. I'm scared for that, but that's part of space travel.
I always looked at the colonization of the moon as a proof of concept for eventually getting to Mars, but I don't know. Everybody seems to be skipping that entirely.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there are more resources on Mars. That is true. But, I mean, Mars barely has an atmosphere. It's not like that really helps that much. You still need shielding. You still need pressurized living spaces. You still need, for the foreseeable future, to send all the resources there in terms of food and everything. The moon, you could put a mace, you could put a base in one of the craters on the poles of the moon. There's water there, not as nearly as much as on Mars. But in any case, I agree. I agree with the let's flesh out the Earth-Moon system and put a permanent base on the moon. And then, you know what? You can fly from the moon to Mars a lot easier than you can get from the Earth because there's a lot less gravity.
1/6.
It's something to be said for using the moon as a stepping stone to the rest of the solar system, not just Mars.
Yeah, because you would need less fuel, right? Like, you could actually get more supplies if you had some sort of supply stock on the moon.
Yeah,
but, I got to be honest with you guys. I don't know how much money we would save and how much easier it would actually be if we use the moon as a way station, because you still have to get stuff into Earth's orbit, right? Unless you're developing fuel on the moon, if you're using the moon's regolith to create fuel.
Well, sure, that's possible. And it's also just let's develop the technology to have a permanent base off Earth a little closer to home, 3 days rather than 3 months away.
Yeah, you could send in like a real rescue mission if something went wrong. Like if something goes wrong close to Mars, it's just kind of, well, I guess that's what you signed up for. But if we're trying things out and we're testing new technologies with real people, wouldn't it be nice for them to only be 3 days away?
Yeah. I agree.
I also think 2020, 2030, maybe to visit Mars, but to establish a colony, I think it's way too soon. I mean, I think the long-term vision is great. I think we will one day have a colony on Mars. Mars will become a self-sustained habitat for humans. There's no reason why that won't happen. And it's great. I love having crazy billionaires doing stuff like this. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But this was not, this is a thin proposal, right? This did not have a lot of details. And there's a lot of big questions that are not answered here. The idea of this is going to save humanity, okay. I mean, I agree eventually it's a good idea for us to be a multi-planet, even multi-system species, you know, so that we don't get wiped out by that gamma ray burst, you know, it's going to hit us eventually or whatever.
Climate change.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't see this as a solution to climate change. I would just, how about let's fix climate change, you know. But
I agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there are things
I think that might happen first.
There are things that we can't do anything about, like a gamma ray burst. In any case, yeah, it's. I think we have to see how this develops. It's kind of like the Mars One project. Yeah, it's a. I, you know, appreciate your enthusiasm, but the devil is in the details, and we're.
Yeah.
We're,
does anybody actually think Mars One is going to happen?
No.
I don't think so.
Well, and the thing that we have to remember about SpaceX, too, is like, yes, I do hope that he can get some billionaires to invest and to really want this. But the truth of the matter is SpaceX's number one investor, not in a traditional sense, but in the sense that SpaceX is a contractor. They get most of their money from NASA.
Yeah.
And NASA doesn't have enough money for this. We already know that.
Right.
Yeah, but what he's doing is trying to fund this with profitable companies like
which is I hope works.
Yeah.
I hope it does.
But his companies,
but as of right now,
are not profitable yet. You know, his triad of SpaceX and Solar City and Tesla are still money pits for him. He's investing on the hope that they will become profitable in the future. But they haven't turned that corner yet.
Yeah.
So that's I think might ultimately determine the success of at least Musk's plan is. Will he be able to find the investors to keep these things going until they start turning a profit? And how long is that gonna take? You know. Well, Kara, you're going to tell us about a new big data project.
It looks like the National Science Foundation has just awarded a decent grant to the Encyclopedia of Life, IBM, and the Georgia Institute of Technology. And these three institutions together are hoping to be able to take a lot of data, a bunch of data that already does exist, but cross-index it and allow new science to be done and also new analysis to be done out of it. So let's look at the major components of this new project. It's basically a merging in many ways of the Encyclopedia of Life and the technology behind IBM's Watson. So have you guys heard of the Encyclopedia of Life?
No.
It's really cool. Like, I've been looking into
it. The Dictionary of Life.
Yeah. So I've been looking into this since I read about this new grant. Encyclopedia of Life is supported by a bunch of institutions. The Atlas of Living Australia, Harvard University, the Marine Biological Laboratory, the New Library of Alexandria in Egypt. I both love and am worried that they decided to call it that. The Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. And let's see if I can tackle this one. La Comisión Nacional para el Conocimiento y Uso de la Biodiversidad. Yeah. So those institutions combined, along with collaborations from the Biodiversity Heritage Library, the Barcode of Life, the Catalog of Life, and the Global Biodiversity Information Facility, have compounded into one open access place where you can log in for free and you can access everything, information and pictures of all the species known to science, which is very cool. I mean, it's
all
a ton. Yeah, all of them.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's like started as 30,000 pages when it launched in 2008, and now it's more than 2 million pages.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
taking the Encyclopedia of Life and realizing that it is somewhat searchable, but it doesn't have that AI component to it, once they can combine their efforts with these computational endeavors, including Watson, which of course, if you guys, we talk about Watson all the time on the show. I think most people know what Watson is. It's a question answering computer system that was actually first developed in order to play and win at Jeopardy.
Yeah.
And has since, so that was in 2011, and it's since then been, you know, it continues to be developed, and it utilizes AI in order to dig through what they call unstructured data. And apparently 80% of all data today is unstructured, like news articles, social media posts, research reports, data from different companies, like their enterprise data. And so using the AI of Watson and combining it with the big data that already exists with the Encyclopedia of Life, the hope is that researchers from all over the world can use this open access data to be able to answer questions. And that ultimately you're going to be able to say something like, how many, the example in here is something like, how many purple butterflies are there in Africa? And that it would actually be able to use the AI to answer a question like that, which is actually way more complicated
awesome.
Than it seems. It's really awesome. And ultimately, they want to be able to answer questions like have you guys heard of the paradox of the plankton?
Is that from SpongeBob?
It's basically the case that ecologists have found and computer scientists have found that when they look at plankton, there is an unexpectedly wide range of species considering how many resources are available. So every time they try to computationally model the ocean and the plankton biodiversity in it, it always seems to be somewhat contradictory to the amount of resources that they've been able to calculate. Okay, the way that they describe it in the article, there's actually a quote here from Jennifer Hammock, the program director at the Encyclopedia of Life. She says, scientists working with computer simulations, quote, try to model what happens in the ocean by saying that the sun shines in and the algae grows. It has a kind of rough approximation, but they can't get the computer model to be stable. They go at it for a while and then it crashes because the model's too simple. And they hope that if they can show a little more diversity in their modeled biosphere, that the model will be able to become more stable. The paradox is, how does this ocean biosphere exist and why doesn't it crash? And it looks like all the data's there. You know, we talk about this problem a lot. Data exists. We know this with like the NSF. We know this with different governmental organizations that are collecting sometimes our private data that we don't want them to be collecting, is that they have it all, but they don't know what to do with it because they can't catalog it and they can't access it that easily. This has been a big data problem across the board, which is a big reason for developing AI and neural networks. But this is a really interesting case where maybe being able to put those powers, you know, the big data along with this supercomputing power together, we'll be able to answer incredible questions about the biodiversity on life that we've never really been able to answer before.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of those computer apps that's going to change how we interface with our computers and with data. And of course, you'll see it first in high-end applications like this. But mm-hmm. imagine if you had a similar application that can sort through unstructured data on your own computer. You could ask it, show me any pictures that contain these two people, but not this third person.
Oh, wow.
Between in this date range or in this context or taken with a flash or whatever.
I want that so bad.
I know, right?
It starts of that. It's true.
Trying
it's
to like, find a damn picture on my phone.
We have the nibbles of that right now, but
we
this,
do.
You're right, is
we
going
do.
To enable us, hopefully, to be able to do it with much more accuracy. Like, if you guys have uploaded, do you guys have iPhones?
Yeah.
No. I have Android.
Okay, so at least I can't speak to the Android, but if you look at your iPhone now, if you've updated to the new OS, when you go to your photo albums, one of the albums is called People, and it's done a pretty decent job. If you look at it, 482 pictures of me, 88 pictures of so-and-so, 53 pictures of my boyfriend. The problem is many of the people is all me. Like, it's just I look different in some pictures. So there's a whole folder, it looks like, of pictures of me without my glasses. And then there's a whole folder of pictures of me with my glasses because it still can't tell the difference.
I see.
But it is getting closer.
The iPhone's got prosopagnosia.
Yeah, exactly. But we are starting to see kind of piecemeal this change. But the ability to take like this unstructured data in that's incredibly complex and ask more complex research questions. And then you're right, be able to search your whole computer.
Find any email where I talk about this topic.
Oh my God, that would be so great. Wouldn't that be great?
Right.
Like using context clues instead, if you're like, I can't remember that one term I used, but I know it means this.
Right.
It to be able to find, you know, because those are the times when it's so frustrating when you can't find that one email because you can't figure out what the term was that would help you find it.
But at that point, we're talking to our computers and they're understanding complicated tasks. And
this has the vocal recognition. That's why that's one of the reasons that they like the use of Watson, because Watson will be able to answer. It's based on human speech. Like, that's its platform.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the point, Jay, is that you have an application that enables you to interface with not just your computer, but with data, like, you know, Google searches. You know, we joke about having the Google foo, right? Knowing how to do a good search is a skill set because it's hard. It's often really challenging. Yeah, to try to search on the right term. Sometimes it takes me time just to find the right term to search on. Imagine if I could ask in normal speech conceptually what I'm looking for and the application has the AI to find it. Because it can search the big data conceptually, and it's not just a, you know, following a narrow word search.
Yeah, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be, you know, some artificial super intelligence. I mean, it would be just minimal, you know, like more, you know, kind of between what, like an
it's Watson
and AI, Steve.
It's an AI system like Watson, but you know, something that you could have on your desktop or in your iPhone or whatever.
Well, and didn't Google just come out with that new kind of personal assistant, like their answer to the Siri problem? And I think it's starting to solve some of those questions where you can talk to it. It will help you with your Google searches, but it'll also do what it's starting to do now, which is search your calendar, look at your maps. It's getting to the point now where I love it, but it freaks me out. Depending on where I am at any time, I can look at my phone and it'll be like, it'll take you 27 minutes to get home, which is fine. That makes sense. But there are other times when I pick up my phone to check my email and it's like, you should leave soon. It's going to take 47 minutes to get to therapy. And I'm like, fuck, you're right. I got therapy.
That's
in 50 minutes. It's getting crazy.
Personal
like they just
assistant.
Know.
Guys,
exactly.
Guys, we're seeing the beginnings of it. If you look at all of the new business proposals, the new companies that people are trying to get started, all the, you know, the big ones, not little ones, most of them, the vast majority involve artificial intelligence, AI. It's everybody is trying to incorporate that into their business model. And sure, a lot of them are going to fail, but a lot of them are taking off. And we're just seeing the beginnings of it now. The next 15 years are going to be incredible with this stuff.
I think we're going to cross a line and you get that killer app and then it'll be suddenly you will not remember what it was like to live without it.
Yeah.
It's really good.
It'll be like the rise of the smartphones.
Yeah, it's going to completely change
VR
our experience.
As well.
Yeah, it completely changed our experience.
And then what will happen, Bob, is our skills will start to diminish.
Oh, they already have.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
we'll lose our Google skills because you won't need them.
I do not know the landline phone of the house I effing live in. I could not tell you it right now, and I don't care because I don't need to know the damn thing.
Google.
I pretty much only know my own phone number, and that's it. Seriously, just the other day, somebody asked me, what's Jocelyn's cell phone number? I'm like, I don't know. It's Jocelyn. It's in my cat.
I've been trying to memorize my wife's phone number. Yeah.
I hit her face on my smartphone, and it calls her, you know?
Amazing.
All right. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses. Jay, they're still great after all this time.
I think they are. And I don't want your ego to get boosted when I say this, Steve, but I listened to one of your courses last week.
Just one?
And Steve, I know you have two. Yeah. But I got to tell you, man, even though you're my brother, I think you're really cool.
Thank you.
Steve has a great course about how to turn on your lightsaber without cutting your arm off.
Mm-hmm. 36 hours.
And in addition to both of Steve's amazing courses that will help you be a better skeptic, you can also learn about physics by one of our favorite guests, Sean Carroll.
Yay.
He has a great course called Dark Matter, Dark Energy, The Dark Side of the Universe. And it really kind of explores what we know to be true about the universe as opposed to what we believe and speculate to be true, and focuses on, you know, the 95% of the universe that seems to be made up of dark matter and dark energy.
And with the Great Courses Plus, stream as many different lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere, from your smartphone, tablet, laptop, TV, tricorder, whatever you want.
And we want SGU listeners to sign up for the Great Courses Plus today because they're going to give SGU listeners a very special offer, an entire month of unlimited access to all the lectures for free. You cannot wait. You must do it now. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. Let's move on. Guys, have you seen this video? I blogged about it earlier in the week, this video circulating. It's a yes. South African panel discussion at a university.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no. I'm
talking
what's going on?
About decolonizing science. So this is complicated. It's always more complicated than you think, right? Superficially, it's one of those things where you watch it and cringe. And I do think that it is cringeworthy, but it is the tip of a deeper kind of story. So let me just tell you what the video shows. So of course, the person who posted this one, you know, like 3 minute segment to YouTube is somewhat taking that out of context because they're showing just, you know, the most, interesting
egregious
bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So essentially it shows a student who's sitting on a panel in a discussion. It looks like just in a classroom. There is a fallist movement. Are you guys aware of the fallist movement?
I've not heard of it before.
No.
Is that a parachuting movement when people jump out of planes?
No. So it's the notion that some institution must fall. You know, that it's so corrupt, it's so rotten to the core, it's so counterproductive or represents some injustice in the world to the point that you really just have to get rid of it.
Well, that's kind of what Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump's platforms have been in many ways.
Yeah, it's definitely an extreme platform, either on either side of the spectrum. I do agree with that. Let's burn it down and have something new arise from the ashes. So like capitalism must fall, you know, or whatever, just pick it. So the idea here is applying that to science as it manifests in countries like South Africa that have historically been colonized by European or Western countries.
But science isn't an institution. It's a
an institution, but I think it's different than a lot of other institutions. But this is what causes the controversy, right? So the person in the video is essentially saying that science must fall, that if you take Western science is just one more piece of colonization, of colonialism.
Wow.
And that in order for South Africa to be truly decolonized, if you believe in the decolonization, then you must completely erase Western science and start afresh with African science. And she has two examples which establish her point. One is, and this is only a slight paraphrase, you could watch the video. She says, basically, we learn that Newton, who is some guy, he saw an apple fall. He made up gravity, wrote down some equations, and now that is taught as scientific truth forever all over the world. Right? So that's her understanding of the science of gravity. You know, it's like Newton saw an apple fall, made up gravity, and wrote it down.
So she's not talking about the fact that that's how many kids learn about gravity, and that's a problem.
That's a good question. So there is a discussion about whether or not that was the context. I don't think that's what she's saying. And I did at the request of somebody who commented on my blog, watch the entire 2-hour video bracketing this conversation. So not just this 3 minutes, and also read several commentaries after the fact to try to put this into context.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say that even the people defending the position that she was taking were not arguing that she was being misinterpreted or taken out of context. They were just saying that she was wrong, that her opinion is not representative of the other panelists or of this movement in general. So they weren't saying, oh, no, that's not what she meant. They were saying, yeah, she did mean that, but we think that she's just one student who happens to be wrong and is not representative. That was their defense. She's not representative. Not that she was taken out of context. So in any case, the other piece is that she says that there are practitioners of black magic who believe that they can summon a lightning and send it a lightning strike and kill somebody else. And okay. that Western science can't explain that.
We can't explain why they say it?
No, why that happens. They can't explain that somebody could summon lightning and kill somebody else. And
can't.
Therefore, Western science is not compatible with African beliefs.
Oh no!
And they need a science that's by Africans, that's compatible with African culture, that is meaningful to Africans, to their society, to those people. Not like it's learning about what some white guy said 200 years ago and then trying to apply that in a village that has no idea what they were talking about. Yeah, I had a lot of problems, of course, with that position. Again, I always try to be fair. I'm trying to be fair to her, trying to be fair to the panel and to this movement, this position. Clearly, there are other people, Kara, who take the interpretation, not of what she said, but of the movement as to what you say. Mm-hmm. The problem is not with our understanding of gravity, but how it is taught, that it's taught in an authoritarian some white guy said it, so believe it sort of way, rather than, and also in a very sort of Eurocentric way. A lot of people brought up the point that, you know, science that we have today was not all invented by European guys.
That's right.
You know,
yeah, a lot of it was Middle Eastern.
Yeah.
Like most math was Middle Eastern.
Greek?
Asian, yeah. Greek, Middle Eastern. Absolutely. There's a lot of influences. It's a rich and complicated history. It's not all European.
There's also a lot of good African science.
Yeah.
Like a lot of what we know about epidemiology and disease control has actually happened by African scientists in these epicenter, these like places where certain diseases started. A lot of what we know about HIV, we know of from African scientists and European scientists working in, or Australian scientists, whatever, working in Africa. But there were many, many African scientists involved in that.
Absolutely. So, you know, my take on this was, I think it's very similar to postmodernism in mm-hmm. that, yeah, the whole intellectual notion of postmodernism has a point. You just can't apply it to science in the same way that you apply it to art or yeah. culture. And my argument was that science is inherently anti or trans-cultural. That does not mean that it is not embedded in culture, because scientists are embedded in culture and they cannot completely remove themselves from their biases or their culture. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of decisions about what to research, how to fund it, how to ask questions. There's a lot of priorities in science which are established culturally. And of course, there's tons of historical examples of science being abused for some political, ideological, cultural purpose. Sure. But that's the institutions of science. The methods and the process and the philosophy of science is all about rising above cultural biases, weeding yeah. out biases, getting to some truth that is correct regardless of what culture you come from. Mm-hmm. And I think that while that's hard and we have to grind that out over a long period of time, the history of science is actually one of scientists eventually coming to conclusions that are the opposite or very different from what their cultures believed. And in fact, changing, it's not reinforcing culture, it's actually hitting us over the head with no, reality is different than what right. your cultural biases tell you it should be. We're yeah. not at the center of the universe. We're not at the peak of evolution. We're not the superior race to others. Mm-hmm. You can abuse it all you want, but eventually it's like, nope, that's not true. This is, and the other thing about science is that it's transparent. It should be transparent. It's egalitarian. You know, it's kind of everything that you want it to be if you're looking for a international, universal kind of process. Yeah,
yep.
That if you want to be decolonized, then embrace frickin' science. That's a good way to do that, in my opinion. And you can engage with the international scientific community purely on the merit of your work and your ideas and your arguments, regardless of where you're from or what culture you're from or what part of the world that you're from. And so I think it's very misguided to it's like throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, it's very misguided, in my opinion, to say that, well, we have to get rid of Western. There's no Western science. There's just science.
Yeah, but I think part of the problem really is the terminology and the way that, like, the vast majority of people don't know or don't think of science as a process. They do think of science as an institution or as a body of knowledge. And I think that they also don't make the distinction between basic science and applied science and medicine. So that's where you really get into problems when you go into cultures where Western medicine, science-based, evidence-based medicine, is very offensive to individuals that have deep-rooted non-Western approaches to medicine. And you actually will make it so that it's harder to bring treatments into certain areas, because I do think that you have to have a little bit of that, more of a sensitivity than a pure relativism, which I do disagree with the idea of cultural relativism in most cases. But when it comes to actually trying to come in, like during an Ebola crisis, or come into like a nation in South or Central America, and do humanitarian work, if you come in with a quote Western idea of science and you don't respect at all cultural opinion, you're actually going to make people more afraid of treatment or turn them away from treatment.
Yeah, but that's a PR problem. That's not a science problem.
No, exactly. It's a huge PR problem. But most people think of medicine as quote science. Like, they really don't make a distinction.
Yeah, it's true.
Which is tough.
Yeah. So I agree that that's tricky. But I think we have to learn how to engage with indigenous cultures and you know, historically oppressed populations and colonized, you know, areas of the world, and so that they don't feel like they need to chuck out things like science in order to throw off their shackles, or that by telling them, hey, this is what science has discovered, that we're saying that your culture is wrong or your beliefs are wrong. But it's tricky, because I also don't think that, you know, we should just say, okay, you know, you could keep believing in your cultural beliefs even when they're objectively scientifically wrong, even when they cause demonstrable harm to you and your people and your culture and your society, because, you know, of this idea of relativism, or because I think that is racist in a way. I think that's racist. It's in saying that, yeah, you people are not able to appreciate real science or participate in real science. So
it's true. And I think because of that, I wonder how popular this woman's opinion really is. I bet you she's getting a lot of backlash within her own community.
Well, so on the Facebook page promoting this conference, the person responding to the response to the YouTube video is saying, hey, this is one student. We don't agree with her. This is not representative. We get into the same issue when there are indigenous populations who hunt whales. And they're like, we've been hunting whales for 1,000 years, and you're telling us we can't hunt whales anymore. It's like, yeah, sorry, they're kind of going extinct. Sorry about that. You know, it's
not
your
fault.
Yeah,
but the thing that's so shit. Yeah, it's kind of like, you're not the reason for it. We're the reason for it. But because of that, you can't do it anymore. It's kind of shitty.
It's shitty. Yeah. I know, it's shitty. But I argued in my blog that I think that getting rid of science because you associate that with Western colonialism actually, in my opinion, magnifies the harm of racism and colonialism, because it deprives people of participating in this international effort and what I consider to be the best thing that humanity does, which is science, right? And you're now being deprived. This is more harm being done to you because of the psychological harm, if you will, of colonialism. But we have to try to convince them, don't do that. Don't give into this. Don't magnify this harm by isolating yourself from the good things. You know, embrace the good things. Sure, if you want to reconfigure them in a way that's more compatible with your culture, that's fine. If this was only talking about the way science is taught, I would have no problem with it.
Yeah, that's
true. But, you know, so, and again, that's some of the defense that's all she was talking about. Like, well, I don't think so. I think you're being a little bit too generous there. I think that's not what she was talking about. That may be what other people are talking about, and that's fine.
Yeah, it's like the only way that we can really, I don't know, deal with what she is saying is like, oh, maybe if she said this, it would be appropriate. But That's not what she's saying.
But and we also know that there are people who think that, right? We know that there are people who think that, you know, science has no special relationship with the truth. This is the postmodernist who over apply it to science. It's all just culture, and it is oppressive, and it's just a way for one person to oppress another person by saying they have science on their side. It's all nonsense. It's just philosophically defunct as well. It's just not true. The methods of science actually are designed to, you know, grind towards something objective and universal and transparent. It's hard, and it was a lot of missteps, but the process is inherently anti-cultural. That's the whole point. And I think that they miss that. They just essentially miss what the very nature of science is.
Yeah, I wonder if it's the case, and I could be completely speaking out of turn here, but I wonder if it's the case that many of the institutions in the parts of Africa where she's, you know, speaking from or speaking about, you know, because obviously Africa is a continent. It's not a country. There's a lot of different places in Africa that are varying levels of scientific inquiry. I wonder if part of the problem is that there's still colonial universities. You know what I mean? Like they're branches of Western universities where kids are practicing. And if there was more of an encouragement of African-based universities that are doing scientific inquiry, not feeling like they're doing it for a parent institution somewhere else, if that wouldn't help. It's the same way that we're seeing a movement away from charity in regions where it's just giving, 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 which actually has the opposite effect that it intends.
Yeah.
And, you know, planting seeds in places where the charitable work is actually to enable the individuals to earn their own money.
No, I think there are a lot of structural problems in South Africa and in the universities, and they're addressing those. This was just going off the rails, in my opinion. This is similar. I think I can make an analogy between this and Vandana Shiva in India saying that GMOs are Western colonialism in India. No, it's not. It's science and technology that can be used to help people. And you are wrong to equate it to imperialism.
Yeah. And you're forgetting all the Indian scientists that are on the freaking papers.
Exactly.
Steve, you're being very generous.
I think it's important to address the most generous interpretation of somebody else's position, but I'm disagreeing fundamentally with her point, Jay. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're just being incredibly polite. I mean, and I'm not saying you're wrong in that anyway. It's fine, but I'd like to, you know, the other way to interpret this or to react to this is a dangerous person with very, very dangerous things to say. I find that anti-intellectualism and anti-science sentiment, no matter what her filter is, her sentiment at its core is anti-science. And I'm amazingly opposed to that stance. I don't care what her philosophical bend is and what her reasoning is, to be honest with you. It's almost irrelevant from the fact that her end message is that science is like a demon product of a demon society, and they all need to go away.
And I would agree with you if this woman was speaking here in the States, or if she were speaking in an area where contextually she grew up with the same experiences as you or I did. I the reason that I think it's you have to be somewhat charitable is that we don't know the context, and we don't know what it's like to grow up in these areas, and we don't know what it's like. We just cannot possibly empathize with all of the experiences that they have. Like, we have the blessing of living in a place where postmodernism is a thing that we get to combat. So I think that I want to have a charitable interpretation only because contextually it's completely unfair to say, like, I know exactly where she's coming from.
I don't have to, though. I get you. Look, it's like we all arrive in different ways. You know, the way that we were brought up and the societies that we live in and the language that we speak, which is all handed to us, you know, that shapes our thinking and everything we get exposed to. But I'm looking at her. This is an adult. This is a person that has access to the internet. You know, she was in a learning institution in a school building. So I don't think I'm making a big assumption there. I've had to learn an extraordinary amount of humility, Kara. You know what I mean? I know you know that. I know you know there's a lot of humility in just being educating yourself and learning about the world. I just don't find this to be a humble person at all. This is someone that is threatened by the outside world and wants to barn
burn the building down.
So, Jay, I mean, I think that that's totally fair to say that she is guilty, I think, of hubris, and it needs to be more humble. She is not humble. She's arrogant, I think, in her position, because she's confusing her own understanding of science with the science itself, and isn't giving the other side a fair shake, in my opinion. I absolutely 100% condemn that approach, that sentiment, that position. That doesn't mean that I have to condemn the person. I could understand, you know, that the context is first of all very different than what we're used to. We don't fully appreciate it. It's also deriving from, I think, a lot of legitimate points, but she got to a place that was ultimately, I think, arrogant and anti-intellectual and wrong. And I think we can correct that without being blind to the context, you know, that created it. That's all. And this is just, again, just a way of communicating, because I think what happens if you don't do that, then people will assume that you're attacking the person. And Jay, you know, we get that all the time. Why are you being mean to people and you call people stupid? No, we don't. We don't tolerate anti-intellectual or pseudoscientific or anti-scientific positions or arguments or beliefs, but we are charitable to the people. You know, we don't really blame people for having the wrong idea. She's the product of what she's learned and what she's been exposed to. And, you know, it is one of the tricky things that skeptics have to do, I think, is try to lead people to a more skeptical point of view while not giving a free pass to pseudoscientific or anti-intellectual ideas or arguments. Yeah. I think it's important for us to make that distinction. And often, even when we do, we're accused of not making it. We have to almost go out of our way to be careful to make that distinction and to remind ourselves that people are people. You know, everyone believes things that are wrong or stupid or
not well thought out
or arrogant.
It's all right. You and Kara are right in all ways. What I'm saying though is I feel bad. I can have enough empathy for her in a lot of ways, because I really do feel sorry for people that are that misguided and blind and completely, you know, 180 degrees away from what I think the truth is. But I've spent 20 plus years of my life fighting her brand of anti-intellectualism. And I'm extraordinarily offended by her statements. I was screaming when I heard the video, and I can't divorce the person speaking the words from the words that are being spoken. I can't do it. Sorry.
That's fair. I think my one thing that I would say in response to that is that if you just move away from the idea that she's speaking as though she's talking about science as a process, but if she personally is mistaking science as a process for science as the aftermath of that process, for science as an institution, science as psychology, science as medicine, if she's mistaking the fundamental definition of science, then I think we can be much more charitable with some of the things that she's saying, because there is truth to some of the things that she's saying if she's not referring to science as a process. And it's not that I want to give her the benefit of the doubt, but I also don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I think that it's dangerous to be on either end of that spectrum.
Yeah.
We don't want to make the same mistake that she is and throw out valid points that movement is making, because, you know, at the extreme end, they go too far and become anti-intellectual or anti-scientific. I also, for myself, one final point is that I do develop a sense of whether or not somebody means well. And I will be as charitable as I can remember to be to people who I think ultimately mean well. Then there are people who I think don't mean well.
Yeah.
And I'm much less, if I think they're a con artist or a fraudster, you know, or if they are a shiftless, lying self-promoter like Vandana Shiva, I'm not charitable to them.
I do.
I have the exact same approach when it comes to misogyny and sexism. I know many women who think that if a man says something on the internet or a man says something in life, he should know better. He doesn't need you to teach him how to be right to a woman, blah, blah, blah. But for me, I do think it's important to know what the context is, because sometimes people will write things to me and I know they mean well. They just don't realize that what they're saying is insulting. And then there are other times when it's like, you're a sexist prick.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to stand up for that.
Yep.
For me, there's a big difference between those two things, but I do know people who don't see it that way.
I agree. I think. If you don't distinguish, you end up attacking people who are mean well, but are just whatever, mistaken.
And who could be learning from you. Like, right. Isn't that the point of being a good skeptic,
exactly.
Is helping people learn?
Yeah. Who could be learning, who could be an ally, and you're just solidifying them as an enemy if you make it personal when you shouldn't. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Okay, any last-minute guesses?
Animal, vegetable, mineral. Animal.
Yes, animal. Oh, okay.
I just hope it's not in too much pain, whatever it is.
Yeah.
This is a noisy you sent in by a listener named Matt Dick, and Matt said, the story of this is that we live near a forest preserve, and at the certain times of the year, we get an amazing chorus of frogs that sing in the evening as we go to sleep. It's really spectacular. So one night, he went into the woods, recorded about 5 minutes of the frogs. He loves it. He wanted to know what kind of frogs they were, and he found a toad expert, a frog and toad expert. The guy identified the frogs by listening to him, and he sent a CD. He sent the CD of dozens of examples of frog calls. So here you go. These are frogs of the wood variety.
Wood frogs.
And they love to sing. They sing. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Ryan.
I dig it.
So, got some crazy guesses here. A lot of people wrote in one way or another, making jokes and whatnot. These are baby alligators.
Hmm.
Those are not baby alligators. We got an email from Jeremy Phillips, and he said, finally, who's that noisy? I know easily. Those were wood frogs. The guy, he's a naturalist, and he loves to go out early in the spring, and he
was the frog and toad expert that the guy consulted.
Probably.
Yeah, right. No.
And then about 5 minutes after that email, because I checked the timestamp, a listener named Todd Pearson wrote in. He said, this week's noisy was a breeding chorus of wood frogs, Rana sylvatica, and I'm a PhD student studying the evolutionary biology of amphibians. Todd, you just missed
it.
Sorry, dude, but I did mention you. Thanks.
Yeah.
I had to bring you up because you're basically dedicating your life to these things, and you missed it by 5 minutes. Oh, my God.
This is your one opportunity.
Yeah, that was your time.
What is a person who studies amphibians called? I know somebody who studies lizards is a herpetologist. Mm-hmm. Or does that also apply to amphibians? It is. It's amphibians and reptiles and turtles and, it's everything. Okay.
Don't know.
And orangutans.
He's a herpetologist.
This was a fun noisy. I like the animal noisies. And please keep sending those in. And we have a new noisy this week. This noisy was sent in from a listener named Christopher. Very weird, huh?
Sounds like the radio in my high school car.
It totally has a radio jumping the stations feel
crappy
to it.
Radio.
Is it the manner of reception that we're going for here, Jay?
Well, no, it isn't. It's the overall thing. Like, what is it, right? Of course, but the reason why you're hearing a lot of weird, on and off things, it's part of the clue.
Yeah.
It has to be part of it because there's something about it that when you stumble on it or you'll know it, you'll get why I wanted you to hear that. I just didn't play it when it was all playing normally. Like in the beginning, there's a clue there, like with that jumpiness. Like, why is that happening? What's going on?
Gotcha. Cool.
Right? Very cool. This is a really cool one, guys. I've been doing great. I got to tell you, the audience has been sending me in fantastic noisies. Keep doing it, guys. You know, I can't play them all, and I only pick the absolute, absolute very best. I have to be really provocative. But I'm getting great, submissions. Please do it. Email me your guesses and your submissions to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, Kara, what's the word?
The word this week is taphonomy. And taphonomy was suggested by a listener named Caroline with a K. And Caroline was actually talking about it in a slightly different context, so I'll get to what she said in a minute. But taphonomy is the branch of paleontology that deals with the processes involved in fossilization, specifically burial, decay, preservation, how fossils actually form. The term can also refer to the process of fossilization itself. So taphonomy can be the study of fossilization. Taphonomy can be what happens during fossilization. It's a noun. Related words include taphonomist, also a noun, referring to the person who does taphonomy, and taphonomic, which is an adjective. The word and really the definition of the process itself was coined in 1940 by a Russian paleontologist and science fiction author, which I think is super cool, Ivan Yefremov. And it actually comes from the roots, the Greek roots, taphos, meaning burial, and nomos, which means law. So it's kind of the law of burial, how things are buried. Now, Caroline, when she suggested the word, she actually mentioned it in the context of archaeology and anthropology, and said it refers to the study of decay. In anthropology, it's, you know, the actual decaying of the organism, so very similar to paleontology there. But she said in archaeology, the term is used more broadly to describe the process by which an archaeological record is created, beginning with the production of the artifact and its purposeful or accidental deposition into the ground. It includes various factors like soil, climate and weather conditions, animal and human interference, the choice of excavation places and methods, as well as biases held by the archaeologist. And taphonomic loss is the process by which information about an archaeological object is lost over time. Thought that was really cool.
Yeah. I've heard the term used in the sense of the study of anything that happens after something dies, basically.
Interesting.
What had not just fossilization, but everything that leads up to it as well, you know, so it's, you know, the predation on the body, mice eating the bones, you know, getting buried in sediment and everything.
The production of cadaverine and putrescine?
Sure. Saponification.
I love those.
Yeah, it looks like there's a lot of different ways to kind of break it up. So biostratonomy is actually the study of all the processes that take place after an organism dies, but before it's finally buried. And then there's like different phases after that. There's like the decomposition phase. Yeah. There's bioerosion. And also we know that there's different ways that things fossilize, right?
Sure.
There are imprints. There are ways where they're like remineralized. There are ways where they actually completely decay and new kind of sediment moves into the casing that was made by it. So there's a lot of different types of fossilization. But specifically, I think taphonomy, or at least in its original definition, referred to the study of the remains or the products of organisms that went from the biosphere to the lithosphere. So kind of the creation of the way that fossils kind of occur naturally. Right. Because, you know, if you think about it, we didn't even know that dinosaurs were dinosaurs until the like mid to late 1800s. We didn't really understand this idea of like dead things being a part of kind of the life cycle. And once we started to understand that the things that we dug up out of the ground were actually quite ancient, then we had to figure out, well, how did they get there? Why didn't they just go away like everything else does? So even though it's 1940, it seems like it wasn't that long ago. It was pretty new science then.
Not only that, Kara, when they first started digging up fossils, they didn't realize that they were the remains of living things.
Yeah, isn't
that
crazy?
They formed by some geological process. They were a manifestation of some pattern inherent in the rock that was manifesting
crazy.
Somehow. Weird ideas now that we would think are crazy, but they didn't think that, hey, this is a part of something that was alive in the past and then turned into stone over a long period
like
of time.
That rock really looks like a skull. That's crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's just a rock.
Yeah.
Are you serious? I mean, they would pull up obvious bone shapes like a skull and other bones that were clearly bone and think, wow, what a coincidence.
Bob, keep in mind, this is pre-Darwin, right? Pre-Darwinian evolution. So they didn't think it was a coincidence. They thought that living forms were inherent to nature, and they those forms manifested in different ways as life and as shapes in the rocks. And it was just some principle. Yeah, it was, yeah, but this is, you know, this is very antiquated way of thinking about the world and reality. So yeah, they didn't think it was a coincidence. They thought this was, oh, look, this is these inherent forms in nature manifesting in the rock, just like they manifested living things. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Very quaint.
So retro.
And that's what people would believe to this day if we strike science off the record books and start all over again.
Still going on about that. All the mistakes. All of them.
All right. Let's move on to science or fiction.
By the way, at QED, people were going apeshit over science. So many people told me it was their favorite segment and they have so much fun playing along.
Oh, yeah. That's gold. That is our absolute nugget.
It's all in the presentation.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And whoever thought of it was genius.
All in the
absolute
delivery.
Genius. Okay.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake-a-rooney. And I challenge my expert skeptics. To give their very slick assessment of why they think one of them is the fake.
And occasionally
they're not
wrong. Get it right.
And lately.
Guys have had a couple of good weeks, not Bob, but the rest of you have been.
Oh, that's rough.
What are you talking about? Last week I messed up, but the week before that, I think we wiped.
Last week.
Yeah, but you said a couple of weeks. Couple is two.
It's a new week. Every week's a blank slate.
You're born anew this week, Bob. That's be the science or fiction winner of the week.
Bob is born again?
All right, here we go. Astronomers have demonstrated that the putative planet 9 could explain the 6-degree tilt of the solar system compared to the sun's equator, which is an enduring mystery astronomers have yet to explain. Item number 2, researchers have directly observed capuchin monkeys creating stone flakes similar to the stone tools created by our hominin ancestors. And item number 3, scientists have found that the same species of yeast most commonly used in leavening bread causes many yeast infections in humans. Jay, go first.
Astronomers have demonstrated that the punitive damage is here. The putative planet 9 could explain the 6-degree tilt of the solar system. Interesting.
So I always have to condense these down to bite size, but just so that you understand what that means. The sun's equator tilted 6 degrees compared to the plane of all the planets. Okay. Right? So the planets are all almost in the exact same plane, within a degree or so. But they're tilted 6 degrees from the equator of the sun. And astronomers have no idea why that is.
And then you're saying that Planet 9 could explain this. Okay. But we know that there isn't Planet 9 from outer space. We know that, Steve.
Yeah.
All right, I got to put that one on the back burner because I'm not sure about it. This next one about the capuchin monkeys creating stone flakes. You're talking about the stone flakes from banging rocks around and whatnot, correct?
That's correct.
As opposed to...
He doesn't explicitly say it here. He's implying that there's a little monkey business going on with the stones. I'm not quite familiar with this monkey. I'm not sure. I would think sure, though, that monkeys would do it. I'm not 100% sure, but it seems like, the monkeys are using tools and doing all sorts of different stuff like that. So I just think this one out of the three seems to be the most obvious candidate for science. So I'll just say, yes, that's science. So now I'm down to 1 and 3. The last one here, scientists found that the same species of yeast most commonly used in leavening bread is causing yeast infections in humans. Ah, my God, I don't believe that. I don't know why. I don't know why, Kara, this one bothers me because it doesn't seem like that yeast that we use for food could have a biological effect on us like that. Don't know why my gut is telling me that. God damn it. And I went
Gutty
first.
What's-
I'm going to say that that's science, and I'm going to say the yeast is fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Okay, so the putative planet 9 could explain the 6-degree tilt of the solar system. I mean, I don't know. I like this. I like things where it's like there's a mystery, and then we discover something, and then it actually helps us solve the mystery. I don't know. It would be clean and nice if this were true. Capuchin monkeys use tools. I totally buy that they've been observed to do all sorts of cool things like share in exchange for treats and very, very smart. Primates are smart. I'm never surprised when primates do amazing things. But we don't eat candida or candida, however you want to pronounce it, which is what you get sick from. It's what you get in a yeast infection. If you lady bits, if you take antibiotics, and it's what you get as thrush in your throat if you have HIV or if you have another like thing that compromises your immune system. That's not the same yeast as what's in food, and that's uber gross to think about. I'm having a hard time now. I'm going to say that one's the fiction just because I don't that would be super gross. I don't want that to be true. Yeah, it's no, that's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Crap. Do I go with when I try to look at these and dissect them, what I know about astronomy or whatever tells me one thing. But that's been failing me horribly this whole goddamn year. So do I go with superficial crap and go with my gut? Oh my God. Cause this, the first one here about the Planet Nine, that doesn't make any sense to me because Planet Nine is far away. The gravitational impact on the sun would be negligible. It's certainly not going to twist the sun up 6 degrees. For that to happen to the sun, it would have happened billions of years ago when there were more planets, bigger planets. Who knows what the arrangement was? And I think they probably would have had that effect. But to think that Planet Nine would have an effect like that from that far away, of course you could argue that it was closer. I don't know, but this one is not rubbing me right at all. See, the Capuchin monkeys. Yeah, I mean I could totally see that. They're flinging rocks, hitting rocks, and they accidentally create stone flakes. Now, if they were observed using those flakes as tools, that would be something, but that's not what's being claimed here, and I doubt very much that that's what they did. They just kind of accidentally created them, and that's fine. I could totally buy that. The yeast thing, I was kind of thinking that one was that could possibly make sense because, I mean, I don't know much about yeast, but it's not like you're going to eat it and get a yeast infection because, your gastric acids would take care of that. It would be the yeast would be introduced in some other way to get the yeast infection. But I've never had one. Kara seems to know a lot about them. And I could easily see the Planet Nine one. Something wacky about Planet Nine could have done that. Or maybe... Let me read all the words. Make sure. Computer Planet Nine could explain... compared to the sun's equator, which is enduring. Okay, let's screw it. I'm going to go with what I know about the astronomy and say that doesn't make sense. So I'll say Planet Nine is fiction. Probably wrong.
Ooh.
And Evan.
Oh, this Planet Nine one. Jeez. I mean, how big is Planet Nine that it could have this sort of effect on the sun? Really?
I'll be telling you that very soon.
Oh, gosh. I wish I knew some more about Planet Nine or followed it a little more closely in recent months or any updates on that. This one's, like Bob, this one's really hard to digest. Jeez, why is that? How did that happen? Monkeys, I think pretty much what everyone said is right, that they're making the stone tools. Not sure they know exactly what they're making, and if they are, then that's very, very interesting. Also, how many of these flakes have we found in history that have turned out to actually be monkey flakes as opposed to people flakes? So that'll cause a wrinkle in some things. The last one, last but not yeast, is about these yeast infections in humans. Yeah, I think Kara may have swayed me on this one because thank goodness she went before me. I would not really have a clue, but I think everything she said makes a lot of sense there. All right. Sorry, Bob. I got to leave you alone with Planet Nine. I'm going to go with yeast with everyone else as the fiction.
Okay. So you all agree on number two. Researchers have directly observed Capuchin monkeys creating stone flakes similar to the tools created
by
hominin ancestors. You all think this one is science. Bob clearly has read this one because it's science and he got it exactly right. But it was funny because when I deliberately wrote this in such a way to encourage you to improperly infer that the monkeys were using the stone flakes as tools, I was a little surprised that Jay and Kara, you guys bought that. So you made the inference I hoped you would make.
Yeah, and but still it's thought what? It was true.
saying, that they were using them, that they were actually using them as tools, or that they were deliberately making them, but it didn't dissuade you from it as this, as a science.
That was my argument last week. I'll say
that. That would have been incredible if we saw monkeys making and using stone tools. Hello, science item of the century. That
but
would
they
be
do
amazing.
Use
they don't. Yeah, they use, well, chimpanzees use sticks and stuff, but not stone tools. Whew.
That's huge.
Yeah,
that's huge.
No, I know.
But this is, Evan spelled out why this is a problem. If so, the Capuchins are making the stone flakes, but they're doing it accidentally. They're trying to get lichen or something off the rocks so they can eat them.
Okay.
Gotcha.
They're banging the rocks, and they said, oh, crap, they're flaking off the rocks exactly like hominins did to then use the flakes as tools to scrape or dig or whatever. So therefore, we don't know that every flake we find archaeologically was made by humans. Was made by hominins.
It's, we have to look at the context.
Yeah, they
it.
Could have been made by freaking monkeys by accident. So,
or stupid hominins that didn't know what to do with the flakes.
That's yeah, right. But, they were trying to eat lichen.
But it does suggest again how the first hominins to say, "Hey, this is a pretty sharp little thing I accidentally created here.
Yeah.
I wonder if I can use it for something, like maybe picking the." You know, whatever, the flesh off this bone or something.
Yeah, so, holy crap, I sliced my forearm open.
Hey, this is interesting. So
I could slice somebody else's forearm open.
I could shave my beard.
Hey, Glug, look at this.
So, yeah, very, very interesting. Actually, a little disturbing, you know, in terms of
it is.
Cleanly interpreting the archaeological record of early humans. But, yeah, monkeys were not creating and using stone tools. That would be incredible. Okay, let's go to number one.
Whatever.
Astronomers have demonstrated that the putative Planet Nine could explain the 6-degree tilt of our solar system compared to the sun's equator, which is an enduring mystery astronomers have yet to explain. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
Oh my gosh, how is this possible?
So is Planet Nine enormous?
I knew it, and I just went with the science anyway because
you didn't go,
whatever.
You didn't go with your gutty what's.
So for further background, if you remember, we talked about the fact that astronomers claim that if they examine the orbits of all of the Kuiper Belt objects, or a lot of them, there's some gravitational influence in there, and it all averages out to this, the possibility. This is astronomers Battigan and Mike Brown at Caltech in January 2016 of this year. They said, hey, if there were a planet about 10 times as massive as Earth, and about 20 times farther out than the orbit of Neptune, which I think is like 500, that would put it out at about 500 AUs, then that could explain the perturbations that we're seeing in all these Kuiper Belt objects.
Right.
There might be a planet out there. We should look for it. So it's not been directly observed. We don't know if it's there or not. It's just a hypothesis that might explain all these other observations. Well, now the same scientist said, okay, we have this other mystery. The sun's equator is tilted 6 degrees to the plane of the planets. Astronomers do not know how to explain this, right? Because there should be one planetary disk, you know, unlike the other solar system we talked about last week that has three planetary disks. But in our solar system, there's one star, there's one planetary disk. The physics say they should all be very much in the same plane, and they can't explain how the sun got cocked 6 degrees off of that plane. So they ran a simulation and they said, you know, if Planet Nine were out there and exactly where we think it is, 500 AUs, 10 times the mass of Earth, and the other aspect to it is that Planet Nine's putative orbit is tilted 30 degrees from the ecliptic, from the rest of the planets, 30 degrees. So off the plane of the solar system, over 4.5 billion years, the gravitational influence of that planet, because it's a big orbit, it's tilted so far off the plane of the other planets, and it's relatively massive, that could have slowly moved the planets, not the sun, Bob. It didn't move the sun, but it could have shifted the disk of the other planets off 6 degrees.
That's amazing.
That it basically, over 4 billion years that it would have taken. And they said, you know what? When we run the calculations, it's exactly right. It's 6 degrees. Uh-huh. It explains the 6 degrees. So they're arguing that this is another slice of evidence that supports Planet Nine.
It's pretty slick. I still hate it, but it's pretty slick.
Yeah.
Mike Brown is so cool.
Yeah.
Do you know what his Twitter handle is?
No.
No.
At Pluto Killer.
Yeah.
Isn't that good?
Pluto That's killer, fantastic.
Yeah.
I am going to be really pissed if that planet is there.
Why?
Why? It's just becoming saying. More and more likely.
All right. Well, I'm a hater of it.
Why? What if they name
know.
It Planet J?
All right. Then I'm cool with it. But other than that, I'm silly. Pissed.
No, because then all of our vintage solar system models we can just keep out, right? Because they're never to scale anyway.
Oh, you just say... Yeah, just scratch out Pluto and write in whatever Planet Nine's name is going to be.
Totally.
No. But, yeah, I mean, you know, we have to constantly update and evolve our mental image of what our solar system is like. Like, you didn't know that there were, you know, a few weeks ago, you didn't know that there were centaurs, you know, between Jupiter
True.
And Neptune. Now you do.
Did not.
I've been thinking about it. If the planet is there, we have to call it Planet Nine from Outer Space. That's its full name.
Yeah.
I like
that.
You can't say it's not like going to be like a Pluto or a Neptune. It's Planet Nine from Outer Space. I'm doing research on Planet Nine from Outer Space. Yeah. That's it.
Can
it be in Roman numerals? Because that's cool.
Well,
just for context, people, Plan 9 from Outer Space is a famous, horrible end. 50s movie.
Ed Wood movie. Yeah.
Ed Wood movie, voted worst movie of all time. But his next movie was better.
Yes, gotcha. And it was the number 9, not the Roman numeral 9. I'm sorry, Kara.
Oh, so it can't be.
Right.
I just want the planet to be at the number 9. I think that's a cool name for a planet.
Yeah it is cool.
Yeah.
Apparently, plans cool. 1 through 8 failed, so it was Plan 9. Oh God, what a horrible movie! But you loved
Ed
you
Wood. The
loved,
movie was awesome.
Love to say it. Anyway, was that the one with the gorilla with the diving helmet? Like, was the
yes,
alien?
Yeah, yes.
And the pie plate on fire hanging from the court, you know, whatever.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So, number 3, scientists have found that the same species of yeast most commonly used in leavening bread causes many yeast infections in humans. That is utter bollocks fiction.
Yes,
I made it up. It's a damn lie. What the research actually shows is that the Candida albicans that causes many yeast infections in humans is actually more different than the Saccharomyces cerevisiae that we use to leaven bread and make wine is more different than we thought. And the reason why this is important to researchers is because they were using the bread yeast as a research surrogate for the infectious yeast-like fungus, Candida, and saying, you know what? It's not a good surrogate because they have different switches and different genes, and they're more different than we thought, to the point that you can't really research one and apply it to the other. So you can't research antifungal agents on the bread yeast and conclude that they therefore will probably work on Candida infections.
Yet we do research on mice and apply it to humans.
We don't actually apply it to humans. We just talk about it as if we've applied it.
We just use it as a way to predict that maybe it might apply to humans, but it doesn't.
Yeah, but we would never just do a mouse study and then like approve a drug.
Exactly.
Based on that.
Definitely not, but that's not what regular people think. It worked on
mice.
That's
true.
I'll
that's
try
true.
It.
Candida is so gross.
But there are people who think that you get yeast infections from eating bread. And
that's
they're wrong.
Ridiculous.
Okay.
Kara, I'm sorry. I should have trusted your woman food.
Yes. See?
It was very convincing.
Every woman. Well, not every woman.
And I should have made you. If I should have remembered that you were a woman and made you go
that
last.
I'm a woman. Exactly.
Oh, now you tell me.
All right. Evan, give us the quote.
Science is competitive, aggressive, demanding. It is also imaginative, inspiring, and uplifting. Spoken by Vera Rubin. Who is a famous astronomer. I don't know. Bob, has she been a forgotten superhero of science?
Yes.
American astronomer who pioneered work on galaxy rotation rates.
Yeah, baby.
Yes. Her studies in attempts to explain the galaxy rotation problem led to the theory of dark matter. She's amazing.
Wow. Huge. Yeah. Huge. Yeah.
Amazing. Wow. And still alive, 88, age 88, and kicking it. We all love Vera.
Keep going, Vera.
Awesome. Maybe she'll get to 115, cool. Right, Jay?
Maybe.
But not 122.
All right. Likely. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Doc.
Cheers.
Thanks,
Doc.
Steve.
Happy birthday again, Kara. Enjoy
yes,
your birthday.
Love you, Kara. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I know you're running out right now after doing the show to have your birthday dinner, so enjoy it.
Thanks.
My birthday dinner.
My birthday present. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.